Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is the Deputy Director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Its mission is focused on preventing genocide through research, education, and public outreach. Naomi Kikoler leads a team that explores mass atrocities, whether it be in Syria or northern Iraq. Her team is focused on crimes against humanity. It's hard to believe that in 2017 we're still in need of a genocide prevention team, but whether it's Iraq, Syria, or Rwanda, or Cambodia, or Eastern Europe, it just keeps happening. Why? What are the root causes that drive countries or rogue states to commit mass atrocities against civilians, and what can be done in our modern era to stop it before it even begins? Ms. Kikoler, welcome to The Download.
Thank you so much, Justin, for having me.
You know, it's such a tremendous, I mean, the work that you do is, and we're going to get to it in the segment, but it is something that just blows your mind when you start doing the research on mass atrocities in the modern era. There's so much research and education about the Holocaust, and, mm-hmm. and even my generation is very well aware of Cambodia or, like I mentioned, Rwanda. But, I mean, these mass atrocities, especially when you talk about the Islamic State, continue to happen over and over and over. Is this something that we just don't have enough information about?
You know, it's really hard to kind of comprehend the enormity of the crises that we're facing right now. You know, today, as we sit here, over 500,000 Rohingya have been forced from their homes in under a month in Burma. And they face not only ethnic cleansing, but also a real risk of genocide. Syria, we've got 11 million people have been forced from their homes. Right. Northern Iraq, genocide by ISIS. It seems like the further we get from the Holocaust, 70 years on, we've got more and more international norms that are meant to prevent these things from happening. But we have less political will to actually uphold those commitments. So we've got, unfortunately, a pretty big gap between the rhetoric of never again and the actual reality on the ground for most of these folks.
Yeah, and it blows my mind, especially when you see headlines that say with the invasion of Raqqa and moving ISIS from that stronghold in Syria and then finding mass graves or the stories about the stadium and the prisons. It's over and over and over. And it seems to be that red line that the world, the Western world, said will never cross again, yet it happens monthly.
Yeah, it unfortunately does. And, you know, I got to say, it's deeply humbling to be doing this work because it's the kind of work where every day you think I shouldn't have to be doing this. My grandparents on one side of my family were Holocaust survivors and on the other were part of the Danish resistance. And I think that, you know, despite all of the commitments we've made, we've got a situation where governments don't want to actually have to take the type of action that is going to prevent these conflicts from happening in the first place. I think one of the dangers of, you know, unfortunately, the climate that we're in right now is that a lot of policymakers are focusing inwards. And there's a lot of really real kind of domestic concerns that here in North America, in Europe, people need to grapple with. But if we turn a blind eye to what's happening, we're going to see situations where not only are atrocities happening, but it's going to metastasize. We're going to see large refugee flows. We're going to see a proliferation of, you know, illicit drugs, sex trade, everything that comes out of what happens right. when you fail to actually deal with these crises to begin with.
People might be listening and say, well, we are dealing with it. ISIS is a huge culprit when it comes to atrocities, mass atrocities, religious. A lot of it's religious based, especially in northern Iraq. Is that why the United States has embarked on this war on terror, on war on ISIS, because of the fact that they continue to rack up mass atrocities everywhere they go?
You know, I think it's definitely one of the reasons why the U.S. and other governments have been committed to trying to defeat the Islamic State. I think the challenge that we've got is that it's really just a small part of the broader effort. And when we want to actually protect civilians, you need to do that more than just fighting in a military sense your opponent or the perpetrator of atrocities. You have to be tackling the underground kind of conditions that allowed for those groups to arise. And that's where we continue to fail to do a sufficient, I think, job. We're not addressing the long-term grievances and patterns, be it rampant impunity in a country, mm-hmm. be it discrimination and marginalization of particular communities, be it the dehumanization.
Right, these are all the warning signs that,
exactly.
that your work surrounds. And that's what I thought about when you talk about prevention, but also being able to see the warning flags and the things that go up saying this is a recipe, this is a formula, is how we get to mass atrocities and genocide.
Exactly. We've got this early warning system that the Holocaust Museum has made publicly available. It tracks all governments around the world and looks for mass killing. we've been able to forecast, and for the last 4 years, Burma's been at the top of that list, in particular because of the risk that the Rohingya face. We've been out there trying to call the alarm bells and tell people that what we're looking at is going to be a potential genocide. So today, to sit here in this situation where we're having to advocate again with governments and make sure that the public is aware, what we're basically looking at is a failure to take those warning signs seriously. And, you know, as soon as you start to see bodies piling up, and I hate to put it so bluntly, your tools to be able to stop those atrocities from happening greatly diminish. The political cost increases, the financial cost of what you need to do increases. So we need to get better at acting earlier rather than waiting until those worst case scenarios start to actually unfold.
You know, Burma is not a household. That's not a household story for American consumers of news. Anybody who's paying attention to the world, anyone who's a citizen in the United States, Burma doesn't get talked about by our politicians, doesn't mention. But here we are getting closer and closer to what we classify as genocide.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those situations where for the last 20 years, the Rohingya population has faced really daily persecution. They've been denied their citizenship. They've had their legal rights revoked. In some cases, they've been forced into living in areas that some have regarded as kind of de facto kind of concentration areas. And, you know, I think that public awareness goes a long way, but I would also just say that there are communities that have been persecuted. You know, Iraq's Christians is a community where we've seen their numbers dwindle dramatically and where they have been the victims of horrific mass atrocities. There was a lot of media attention about what was happening to them and to the Yazidi community, but that didn't necessarily translate into the type of preventive action that would have helped them. So there isn't a direct line between attention and awareness and actual policy action. And that's what makes our work so much more difficult.
Naomi Kikoler is the deputy director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Let's do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Ms. Kikoler here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Naomi Kikoler is my guest tonight. She's the deputy director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. We're talking about mass atrocities, which seem, with the war on terror and what's happening both in northern Iraq but also in Syria, seem to be more and more prevalent in a world in which we thought just 50 years ago said never again, more than 50 years ago. I have to ask, it gets very complicated when it comes to politics. Syria is a great example where it's all about getting ISIS out of places like Raqqa. And they are obviously the Islamic State is one of the worst when it comes to mass atrocities. But there's also the Assad regime, which almost if you think about it, we just had Wendy Perlman in here talking about that kind of sparked this quote-unquote civil war about the civil strife that was caused by the Assad regime. In your work, when you're trying to get at governments and prevent genocide, but you have this very complicated situation where both sides are actually causing harm, how do you maneuver that? How do you work around the idea that it's not just a black and white issue?
You know, in the case of Syria, it's actually been fairly straightforward in terms of the key perpetrator. The Assad regime has been, for the last 6 years, complicit and has been not just complicit, but also intentionally targeting its civilian population. And when you look at the scale of the destruction and the atrocities that have been perpetrated, they have been the primary perpetrator. It's been challenging at times because under the Obama administration, there was a diversion of attention away from tackling those crimes to the crimes committed by the Islamic State, the self-proclaimed Islamic State. And to a certain degree, that diversion of attention, unfortunately, took off some of the pressure from the Assad regime. We saw rampant atrocities committed during that time period. And I think what we try to do is we try to remind governments that they have a responsibility to protect populations from all perpetrators that are committing these atrocities, and that it's risky to narrowly focus on one particular issue, one particular tool or strategy that's being used by perpetrators. We have to get better at being able to have a multifaceted response. It is hard when you're trying to explain to the average person that there are, you know, potentially 15 or 13 different factions that are fighting in a particular conflict. But, you know, it's incumbent on governments to do that. We can do that in other negotiations on other issues. We're dealing with climate change right now. If you want to deal with a very, you know, difficult subject, it's that. So we've got to constantly be pushing our policymakers to get better in their analysis, understand the toolbox that they've got available much more than they currently do, and really ensure that they are living up to their international obligations.
Well, what's in the toolbox when you talk about the Assad regime? Because as you said, backed by Russia and Iran, and there's also the U.S. is involved. When you talk about the government supporting that government, Yeah, it gets real gray area. What are the tools available that aren't military? There's a suspected genocide or mass atrocities. What's at the disposal of a government or a place like NATO that would be able to come in and stop it from happening?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned about kind of military responses in NATO. So that's obviously one. And there's been a lot of talk about kind of targeted strikes. President Trump actually did do a targeted strike after the use of chemical weapons, which was something that the previous administration had been quite nervous about exploring. And when we look at the situation right now, there's still more that can be done in terms of economic sanctions and chasing the Assad money, essentially. There is a lot of work that continues to need to be done around justice and accountability. We've got unbelievable evidence right now of the commission of mass atrocity crimes by ISIS. It's actually the most unprecedented amount of evidence that we have, with the exception of the Holocaust. So we can bring cases forward. The challenge is that we don't have venues and forums to be able to do that. So we need to be working with especially European governments to make sure that their courts will be able to, primarily using universal jurisdiction, hear cases against the Assad regime. So there are additional tools out there that we just have to get much better at actually using, in addition to the diplomacy and the political engagement and working with like-minded states to not just pressure the Assad regime, but those that are essentially supporting and enabling them.
If the war on terror and there's the removal of ISIS, and ISIS gets driven out of Syria, will the focus go back to the Assad regime and the atrocities against his people?
You know, I got to be honest, at this point right now, I'm really nervous when we talk about ISIS being destroyed and eliminated because there's always the potential for the reemergence of another extremist group. And having worked on Iraq and worked on Syria, we are beginning to see that that's a very, very real threat. So we might very well see ISIS greatly diminished, but they could reemerge. We are now seeing, unfortunately, the role that Iran has been playing, both in Syria and Iraq, is posing very, very grave threats and adding a new level of complexity. Yeah. They've been there for a while, but a new level of complexity in terms of the dynamics, and their presence might also help lead to reemergence of ISIS. But Assad continues to commit these crimes. And I think there's been more collective international will to work together to fight the Islamic State, a non-state actor, than tackle the crimes being perpetrated by Assad. So I think we're going to continue to struggle, unfortunately, to come up with a durable solution in the case of Syria. And what's worrying is that as we continue to talk about trying to normalize or reconstruct Syria, it's being done without a clear answer as to what's going to happen to Assad. So even if we deal with the threats posed by ISIS, I think there's going to be enduring challenges that are going to present a lot of challenges for the international community in trying to actually come up with a solution.
Naomi Kukoler is my guest. She's the deputy director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the U.S. Holocaust Museum. The one thing I wanted to end the interview with was talking about the bearing witness trips. I know when you talk about mass atrocities or preventing genocide, a big part of that is being able to see it. And we've seen in Raqqa and other places in northern Iraq mass graves. Talk about those trips and how emotional they are to see the actual devastation, the atrocities firsthand, to be witness.
It's definitely very humbling work. And what I'm always grappling with is that I have the luxury to get on a plane and leave. I remember being in the Central African Republic and taking off, and over 50,000 people had sought shelter from attacks by militants on the tarmac of the airport. And I could get out. When I visit northern Iraq, I can leave. The people who we're trying to share their stories of and to make sure that the world does not forget them don't have that luxury. And there's always a danger when you are trying to speak ideally with, but often find yourself speaking for others, because I can never fully understand what it is that the average Syrian, Iraqi, Central African wants or needs. I can, by best, try to translate and ensure that the world knows at least the crimes that happened to them. So for me, I feel like the most challenging thing that I often grapple with is the reality that there's always so much more that can and needs to be done, and that their voice is so much more powerful than mine. Yeah. And I wish that they would be able to have the opportunity to share it. I wish that they could sit down with presidents and prime ministers and go before the Security Council on a daily basis, because who we're responsible to them is essentially them, since they're the ones carrying the burden of having endured these horrific atrocities. we still live in a world where I think there is just, as I said before, such a gap between rhetoric and reality.
Is that why it's so startling to Americans when you see the picture of the Syrian child, or you see something that you would just cringe at this is happening in the world? Because up to this point, we were sheltered. We didn't know anything about it. It's all politics or headlines, and it doesn't mean anything to us. So having that moment where you see something like that and it has this emotional attachment, that has to play a role when we talk about preventing mass atrocities, because it does, as obvious as it is, puts a face to it.
You know, Justin, I was in a Syrian refugee camp in Iraq when Aylan Kurdi washed up on shore. And people were showing me his image on the phone. And then I went to a Yazidi camp. And I had a Yazidi woman who had just finished telling me about how many babies she had seen die on Mount Sinjar. And then she showed me this phone and she said, my heart breaks for them. And I'm sitting there in that moment thinking, this woman has lost so much and she is living in a tent. Yet she's capable of showing empathy for Syrians who she does not know. And, you know, for your listeners, I think the question that I would ask is, how many Aylan Kurdis do we need to see every single week, every single month, for 6 years, for us to be shocked into acting? Because I think we live in a world where we're almost saturated now with these images. And I think at times it does, you know, contribute to some degree of compassion fatigue and a sense that we can't do much. And I simply think that at the end of the day, what we need to constantly be resisting is the apathy. And we shouldn't need the image of Aylan Kurdi to have to act. We shouldn't need to see that in order to pick up the phone and call our senators, our representatives, and ask them what they're doing or support the local refugee organization. But the reality is we unfortunately do need those triggers. And I just really wonder, how much do we have to put out there for us to hit a tipping point where people finally say enough? Because on my side, I don't want to have to constantly try to find the worst story to share. As the grandchild of survivors, you know, there is something sacred about the horrific nature of the crimes that they've had to endure. I shouldn't have to instrumentalize that to make someone care. But it's almost as though we are still trying to find that perfect science of just how much suffering forces those across an ocean in a different country to really do something.
Naomi Kukoler is the deputy director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. We're talking about genocide, mass atrocities in the world today. Naomi, thanks for being my guest. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.